I personally think, you know, from a distance, and I have absolutely no inside knowledge on how Wout van Aert thinks, and, you know, but from the outside, to me, it seems like he has a Van der Poel complex. That, you know, he's been beaten so many times, and you know, at the end of the day, you know, Van der Poel has won the Tour of Flanders twice. He has won Milan San Remo. He's won Paris Roubaix.
Thanks for tuning in to the Move podcast. We've got a lot in store for you, and luckily, I've lined up two of the best professionals in the world to help you understand what went down for the last week or so. I'm JB Hager, and luckily joined by Spencer Martin, who you may know from Beyond the Peloton, and then, of course, Johan Bernil, who you know from racing and all of his grand tour wins, especially as a director for many, many years. So we have a lot to talk about. You know, this past week, the Tour of Catalonia is going on, the E3 Saxo Bank Classic, and then, of course, Gent-Wevelgem, which just happened this morning. Before we break down those races and two riders in particular we're going to spend a lot of time on, let's check in with a couple of our sponsors for some special offers for you. Today's show is brought to you by Bicycle, B-U-I-C-Y-C-L-E. And this is the best way, hands down. They figured it out. To buy and sell your pre-owned bikes. And I was just talking about it with friends recently. About, like, when did bicycles, mountain bikes, road bikes especially, become as expensive as a motorcycle? It's crazy, because it just seems like not that long ago, you know, after a few years, your bike wasn't worth that much. Now, a bike that's a few years old is still worth a ton, and you could sell that bike out of your garage and get into the newer thing that you want. Stay on top of it. Keep up with the times. I've learned the hard way. If you sit on something too long, it's not worth that much when you try to sell it. But if you hit it just right, you can get a lot of money back on a pre-owned bike that you're not using like you used to, and get into what you want. And they have a special offer for us and for our listeners at Bicycle. If you'd like to sell it, they will remove the seller fee. So look through your garage. If you haven't touched it in 6 months, probably time to sell it and get what you really want. And the inventory on their listings is unbelievable. The algorithm, you plug it in, what style, what components, what wheels, mechanical, electric, all of that stuff. And it spits out all the options for you and a lot of savings. It's very, very cool. Check it out. Bicycle.com. B-U-Y-C-Y-C-L-E. Today's show is also brought to you by Mando deodorant. I have one right here. If you're watching on YouTube, this is the deodorant stick. They also sent me a couple of cool creams that are just really nice. You know, it's like it works really well. And it's interesting. And this is a true story. My daughter was really on me years ago for not using an aluminum free deodorant. She's like, you know, you realize what you're doing to yourself. And so I went online and bought like 10 brands and tried them all a few years ago, and it was hard to find one that worked at all. And then when we got this Manda, which is aluminum free, it was easy to make the switch, and it smells better. It's just like, it's really, really nice. So check it out. It really, really is a great product. Been happy using it, and I'm a lifer. I'm switched to it. Special offers for our new customers. You can get $5 off a starter pack with the exclusive code and link. Use the code WEDU, W-E-D-U, at shopmando.com. Again, WEDU at shopmando.com. Okay, now let's jump right in with a one-day classic, the E3 Saxo Bank Classic. For those who've never watched this race, Johan, give us just a broad picture of the history of this one versus, you know, some of the monuments that they may be more familiar.
Yeah, I mean, E3 is a race that's been on the calendar for a long time. In Belgium, it's known as the Mini Tour of Flanders. It uses the same roads, the same climbs, not in the same order, but it's, you know, in general, it's looked as the last big rehearsal for the Tour of Flanders, because it's the same racing style. And usually, you know, it's always a big rider who wins there. And this year was no different. You know, it was the first time this year that we saw Mathieu van der Poel and Wout van Aert against each other, which was something, of course, that in Belgium was long awaited. And we didn't really know. Well, Van Aert, you know, had been really good in the first weekend, but then went on a 3-week training camp at altitude. Mathieu van der Poel had started his season in Milan San Remo, showed that he had a good form, but, you know, to see these guys together on their favorite terrain and on the cobbled walls in Flanders is something that, especially in Belgium, it's been building up for a number of weeks. And so finally that was the big day where we finally could see them together against each other.
And historically, wasn't this always kind of a big week, this time of week, like as a tourist, you can catch, like, we're going to talk about Gent-Wevelgem in a second, but this time of year, you can catch 2 or 3 races in 1 week in this region, right? That's another reason.
If you stay in Belgium now for 2 weeks, you can watch so many races. It's crazy. You know, there's basically an important race every 2-3 days. E3, then today Gent-Wevelgem, then, you know, we have Tour Flanders next, then the next week, and then Paris-Roubaix. And in between, there's a bunch of other races. I don't know them all by heart now, but it's a dream for any cycling tourist coming from abroad to be in. This is the 2 weeks. They call it the holy, whatever, the holy 2 weeks of cycling in the north of Europe.
Well, we'll jump right into that. We got to see an amazing performance by Mathieu van der Poel. We did see Wout van Aert, as you pointed out, a much hyped head-to-head match. But we did see Wout van Aert go down, and then that van der Poel had already attacked. So it's not like he needed to sit up for that. That's when the race was going down. And then that gap just stayed for so long. I felt like they were, even though van der Poel got the win, those were two very evenly matched riders, but one with less of good luck, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, JB, it's interesting. I rewatched the race last night on the trainer, and I kind of came away with a different perspective than the first. The first time I watched it, I'm glad we didn't do the show, because I would have come on and said, oh, wow, no one's going to beat Mathieu van der Poel. He's the best rider in the world. Cancel the classics. He's going to win them all. And then I went back and rewatched, and Johan mentioned something yesterday when we spoke that, you know, you're like, so Wout van Aert crashes on the Paterberg. If you go back and watch before that, though, he is kind of slow to respond. Like, van der Poel was extremely aggressive, extremely. You could almost say recklessly so. Little Trek was massing at the front, doing a good job, probing him, trying to take the race to him. He's just like, nah, I'm not going to worry about this. I'm just going to attack you guys all the time. It was actually shocking how many attacks there were between the start of the coverage and the Paterberg, which is the big moment of the race. It's just constant churning and attacking. They get to the Paterberg. Van der Poel's on the front where he should be if he wants to make a move. Van Aert's a little further back. You know, he kind of tries to make up ground at the last second. Stefan Kuhn's in front of him, puts him in a weird spot. He slips in the gutter. It was like extremely steep gutter. He just slips out there because he was probably out of position trying to get back in position. You could say that's bad luck. Upon rewatch, I kind of thought, yeah, that might have just been him not being sharp enough, because he's been in an altitude training camp doing long climbs, just not having race sharpness. You know, I think we described it yesterday when we were talking, Johan, as strong but not polished. So, you know, even if he doesn't crash there, he was having the problem that he just wasn't responding the exact, like, there was one point where van der Poel attacked and Matteo Jorgensen went on his wheel and Wout had to slowly chase back onto them. If he's doing that already that far out, realistically, is he going to beat van der Poel even if they go to the line together? So, yeah, I don't know how much his luck, the luck of the crash really affected him, but we should say he crashes on the Paterberg, worst place in the world to ever crash, because you're starting from a stop on an extremely steep cobbled climb. He gets back on. Van der Poel's attacking up the road. He gets back onto the group by the top. By the time they get to the Quermont 5K later, he's attacking and dropping everybody else and chasing down Van der Poel, almost gets him. And if you isolate that section of the race, he must have gone, you know, imagine how much faster he went than van der Poel for that section of the race when he's starting from a stop to when he almost catches him. So clearly in good shape, but I'd just say probably not the race sharpness to win, even if he didn't crash right there.
I mean,
and then the other question is, does it matter? Do you want to be sharp at E3?
Yeah. You know, let's not forget, he comes from altitude, you know, so, you know, some people, I mean, a lot of riders actually take a week or so to, you know, get, get the real back to their normal, you know, get the real benefits of the altitude training. And I think Van Aert was really strong. He was not as explosive as Van der Poel. I think the mistake Wout made, I've read a lot of comments, and, you know, and this is just for the American audience, you know, it is so difficult to be Wout Van Aert in Belgium, especially when he's not winning. It is crazy the criticism this guy got from, you know, like, okay, he crashed, but, you know, they criticize him. Yeah, you know, he's always waiting. He's always waiting to see what Van der Poel does. And he's never anticipating. He's always reacting. I think Van Aert was riding great. In my opinion, the mistake he made was, and that's probably a little bit, a tiny bit, you know, if you would ask me, you know, they have this 10-year-long rivalry, right? And they're so close to each other, Van der Poel and Van Aert, you know, physically. I would say it's definitely a mental advantage for Van der Poel, but first of all, because he has one more, and he has one more important races when it was head to head. And I think Van Aert struggles with that. But if you see that on the Paterberg, you're not in the wheel of Van der Poel, it can happen. I mean, listen, I mean, it's not a video game. You know, some people are commenting, you know, on social media and in podcasts and stuff, and they talk like it's a freaking video game. You know, like, okay, you have to do this and this, and then, okay, you have to be there at that point. I mean, it doesn't work like that, guys. You know,
I think that inspired a tweet of yours this past week, didn't it? There was something.
I'm biting my tongue, JB, because it gets worse and worse. But anyways, so they go on the Paterberg, and Van der Poel is in second position, because I think Lascano was in front. And Van Aert is in third or fourth or fifth position. So there's one guy in between, which is, I think, Stefan Kung. Now, and especially in E3, the Paterberg in E3 is different than the Paterberg in Tour of Flanders, because in Tour of Flanders, there's fences. You can't ride in that little gutter. Mm. And in Adelbeke E3, you can ride in there. And if you can ride in there, there's no point of going on the cobbles unless you're just a lot stronger. So Van Aert should just have stayed there, you know, not panic, and not even if Van der Poel attacks, you know, if there he attacks and Van Aert, the way he was riding, is in third or fourth position, there's no way Van der Poel is gonna, I mean, if he has 10 meters on top of the Paterberg, Van Aert is gonna catch him. Now, of course, it was different. He went and, you know, nobody else could match him, but Van Aert was able to match him. So I think he panicked a little bit to see when he was not in Van der Poel's wheel. And then he had to kind of hop off. And there's this little tiny little border. I think that they were kind of also a little bit in the mud at some point. So probably not the same grip on the tires. And, you know, he went down. It was unfortunate. He afterwards, Van Aert said, you know, it was his own stupid mistake. It was not Kung or something who did a bad maneuver. I've seen criticism towards Kung, but he didn't do anything wrong. It was Van Aert's mistake. From there on, basically, I think Van Aert's race was kind of over, I thought. But it's, as you say, Spencer, the performance Van Aert did from the moment of that crash, getting back on his bike, getting his, you know, on the small chain ring, because I think he was on the big chain ring at the beginning of the Paterberg, goes on the small chain ring, starts from a still, which is incredibly hard on the Paterberg because it's the steepest one of all. You know, from last position, then 5 kilometers later on top of the Quaremont, being in first position away from everybody else, and then on top of that, he was kind of closing the gap. There, probably, I think he let himself carry away a bit too much. And, you know, we don't know what happens. And, you know, he probably gets the information in his ear, you know, okay, you know, 20 seconds, 17 seconds, 15 seconds. And you kind of start to, get over enthusiastic. And, you know, Van der Poel was just keeping his rhythm. And then I guess when he saw that Van Aert stagnated, he just pushed it a little more and then Van Aert broke down. The question is, you know, would it have been better for Van Aert to not make that big effort on the Quaremont, try to keep Matteo Jorgensen with him and two or three guys of little trek? You know, in hindsight, that would probably have been a smarter move, because for sure there would have been collaboration. And it was still a long way from the top of the Quaremont to the finish. You know, seeing how Van Aert could kind of diminish that gap with Van der Poel, you know, if he would have lost 5 or 6 or 7 seconds on the Quaremont, but in compensation have Jurgensen and three little Trek guys, that could have been the key to reel Van der Poel back in.
You bring up something interesting, Johan. You're like, you know, they could have collaborated and brought him back. It seems like as of late, when you take these next level riders, whether it's Wout van Aert, Van der Poel, Pogacar, Vingegaard, when they go, everyone's mentally defeated. Like, they're just on such a level that they would have all, when you say collaborate, they're going to stare at Wout van Aert. You're on that level. It's your job, right? Kind of. There's not as much collaboration going on as of late when one of these top tier guys just go. It just seems to mentally destroy them.
Yeah. That's true. Plus, I feel like more and more as we comment and analyze these races, to me it seems like tactics have become such a minor factor in cycling right now, where it's just pure power and pushing your watts, and just they know that if they're at this certain level, they can keep it for such a long time. You know, in hindsight, of course, it's easy to criticize and to say, okay, if they would have done this, then the outcome could have been this.
Can't do that in bike racing because you're moving on. You're focused on the next race at hand, right?
Yeah, exactly. I would have thought that Van Aert, you know, like, he definitely had bad luck with that crash. You know, knowing that it was his first race back after altitude, if he would have been a little bit more prudent on the last part of the Quaremont and be more conservative, they could have done something else. But they, you know, maybe at that point he was, and you know, he had the crash, the adrenaline, you know, like getting back into the race, you know, from a moment, of course, when he crashed, for sure, he said, okay, my race is over. He gets back up, moves up, gets back in the, you know, on top of the Quaremont, he's in first position. He gets the adrenaline. Okay, I'm back in the race. I still have a chance. And then you just keep going. So, you know, it's difficult to say, hey, you shouldn't have done this, you know?
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. If you really, I know some people say like, oh, if he doesn't attack, then that group stagnates because who's going to work with Van Aert? But he has a teammate. He has Jorgensen, and there was another climb left. So in theory, Jorgensen works as hard as he can until the bottom. They called it like the E3 Berg. That's not the real name of the climb, though. Just like sell out to the bottom of that climb, and then Wout should have attacked. That's what if you're going to do it over again, you know, he probably could have made contact with Van der Poel. The question is then what does he do? Could he have beaten Van der Poel in a sprint? Maybe not, but you hit the nail on the head, Johan. He didn't. So he's not on Van der Poel's wheel at the bottom of the Paterberg. Not ideal, but it's not a catastrophe. The catastrophe was panicking and then crashing, because he was going to reel in Van der Poel. Like, let's say he is 3 seconds at the top of the Paterberg, Van Aert's going to get that back. That's not.
Well, yeah. And also, you know, I mean, Van der Poel would go full gas. Van Aert would go gas. And if Van der Poel looks behind and he sees that Van Aert is on 5 seconds, he won't keep going. You know, it's not like he has, because he knows Van Aert really well. He says, okay, you know, that's just wait. And then for sure he will collaborate and we'll just sprint for it or something, you know? But you know, those are,
is that, we are probably reading too much into this, but is that a mental mistake he would only make because it's Van der Poel? And does that rattle him at all, the head-to-head matchup with Van der Poel?
I personally think, you know, from a distance, and I have absolutely no inside knowledge on how Wout van Aert thinks, and you know, but from the outside to me, it seems like he has a Van der Poel complex. That, you know, he's been beaten so many times. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, Van der Poel has won the Tour of Flanders twice. He has won Milan-San Remo. He's won Paris-Roubaix. Vought for the moment has one monument, Milan-San Remo. But, yeah.
Sometimes you need, as a director, did you ever need to remind a writer that, you know, with the big paycheck comes the pressure too? That's part of the game.
They know that. I mean, Listen, they know that. And we can't really say he did everything he could. Plus, in my opinion, they definitely had factored in, the fact that he just came from altitude and, you know, let's see how it goes. Right. So to me, that's probably the biggest conclusion, that if you are in a situation of let's see how it goes, then, you know, gamble and take the risk and let's see how it goes. And let's just wait for a few guys and see if we can collaborate, because Van der Poel's out there and it was still far to go, you know, from the top of the Quadermont. What was it, like more than 30K to the
headwind too. So you'd think you're not going to stay away. Also, people are reviewing the movie 5 minutes into the movie. Like, he didn't go to this training camp for E3. You know who's been amazing at E3 the last 2 years? Wout Van Aert. You know how many monuments he's won after that? Zero. So I don't think that he's building up to E3 and what's he doing? Dwarves, Vlaanderen. It's all about Flanders and Roubaix.
So. Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure. He changed his whole program and his whole strategy and, you know, stopped cyclocross early. All for these two races, you know, Flanders and Roubaix. So we're here now, we're, you know, commenting and analyzing these performances in these races. But at the end of the day, Flanders is, you know, it's still a week from now, or a week from tomorrow.
A week from,
And it's a different race. So, you know, to be honest, I'm a bit more concerned. I mean, not concerned at all about Wout Van Aert. I'm a bit more concerned. This may sound strange. I'm a bit more concerned about his team. Yes. You know, it may seem strange to say that, especially after how they dominated the first weekend of the classics. But, you know, for some reason they had, Van Baarle had a flat, I think, in E3. Then they had another guy crash and Tratnik crashed today. And so, you know, we'll have to see when their complete A team is for the classics is together. That will be in Flanders. It seems like that's the key to beat Van der Poel. It's strength of the team, have several cards to play with. Whereas Van der Poel is, you know, probably the only guy of Alpes in Phoenix who can win these races like E3 and Flanders, especially.
And we can't spend too much time on this because we have two more races to cover. But, you know, this week, good news for Vanderpool. Good to be Vanderpool with a 10-year bike deal with Canyon and an Alpecin extension, I think.
5 years.
He's in a good place, right?
Johan, how does this work? If I guess we've seen this before in a de facto fashion with Sagan. You know, he essentially specialized moves around with him. So what happens if in year six, Vanderpool goes to another team? Does Canyon follow? He can only go to Canyon teams, I guess, right?
Yeah, but in 5 years, in my opinion, Mathieu van der Poel is going to retire. I mean, this is his last contract. You know,
but he'll still be such a high profile name.
It's beyond. I think Canyon is investing in the brand van der Poel, you know. This is the brand and, you know, this is what it's worth. And it's amazing actually to see that, I mean, that the cyclist, because, you know, cyclists are, you know, usually very popular as long as they race and win races. But this is different. I mean, he's a household name. He's super popular everywhere. Canyon, hey, I mean, listen, it's probably the best guy to be associated with. You know, he's one of the biggest stars on the road. He's definitely the biggest star in cyclocross. He can be one of the biggest stars in mountain biking. They have everything covered. But a 10-year deal is exceptional. I mean, I've never seen this before. There's always a first.
Yeah. I have one last
bargain, whatever they're paying him. I mean, you watch him today off the front and you want a Canyon. You know, he's the best ad you could have, and he's not a GC rider.
And how about how nice is that completely white bike, Spencer?
Yeah.
You know, I
yeah.
think there's just a little tiny detail on the back, like the world champion, like the rainbow. Maybe only on one side. But it's like, you know, a completely white Canyon. It just looks great. You know, the Van der Poel in the rainbow jersey on that white bike. It's a great image.
Sorry. One last thing about Van der Poel, because we do have to cover more. If you saw him go across the finish line at E3, and if you're watching on YouTube, we can put up an image, but if you're listening to it, I'll do my best to describe it. It's a breakaway finish, so he's out of the bars. He's standing up, straight-legged, holding the saddle with his thighs, and does a one-arm salute, military salute. And I was thinking, I kind of want to try that next time I'm on the bike. I've never stood up like that, just straight up.
Make sure you have a good helmet on, JB.
It was badass, crazy. Though.
I mean, you know, listen, these guys, they're amazing backhandlers. I've seen Wout van Aert do this, the same thing, for example, when he, in the Tour de France, when he won the stage up the Mont Ventoux, then they came down and he came into the finish solo, and he did the same thing, stood up on the pedals and raised both hands.
Yeah.
And, you know, these guys are top of the world backhandlers. You know, I mean, they're cyclocross guys turned into road racers initially. So
Spencer and I were talking about this before the show. It's like, I can't even take my vest off anymore.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
It's really fun to watch. It's really cool to watch. Okay. Now let's move on to Tour of Catalonia. Even though this is a 7-stage race, we'll probably spend the least amount of time on it because it was the Tadej Pogačar show. 100%. What a performance. 4 wins of the 7.
I know. I mean, it's like, I don't know what it is with these guys. Like, you know, you have Van Aert and Van der Poel, you know, those two, those are the eternal rivals, although there's some other guys who come in between and can sometimes beat them. And then you have this Vingegaard and Pogačar rivalry. Vingegaard starts the season. He does the stage race in Spain, O Gran Camino, wins 3 stages and the overall. Then his next race is Tirreno. He wins the 2 big mountain stages and the overall. And it's like, okay, how can I do better? Look, like, you know, Pogačar starts the season, his first race, Strade Bianche, he does something that we've seen very, very seldom. You know, it's 80 kilometers from the finish attack and go to the finish. And now Vuelta a Catalunya, World Tour stage race. You know, I mean, Landa's there, Enric Mas is there, Vlasov is there, Bernal is there. I mean, there's a lot of good riders. Vingegaard's not there, but it's okay, Jonas, you won 3 stages in Gran Camino, I'm going to win 4. You know, let's see who can do better.
That's what one of the things I thought about too. I go, man, is he sending an early season message? Yeah.
No, in his interviews, I mean, already, you know, really difficult stage, you could see the tremendous difference between his level and everybody else. And from that moment on, you could also see that it was a race for second. You know, you get into a situation where these guys are so good that the other guys, they don't even try. They kind of try, but they try to follow, not with the intention to beat him, but to intention to distance the others that are 3rd, 4th, and 5th. Which is a little bit the race that Landa rode, right? So, but you could see that he was definitely the strongest guy. To me, it was impressive from a visual point of view, the ease with which he's climbing, his cadence, the way he looks comfortable on the bike on those super hard, long, steep climbs, and even at altitude. And on top of that, one of those was in the cold and in the rain. He's just on another level than everybody else. So
Yeah, I kept watching that thinking, I wonder if Landa is putting out some of the best numbers he ever has. Yeah, but it's definitely. As you always point out, there's another 1-2% every year added on. That has to be so frustrating going, because he's been a great rider for so long. I'm putting out the best numbers of my life, and the guy just rides away. Unbelievable.
Yeah. I mean, I second everything Johan said. Unbelievable performance. Like, should go without saying. But I'm seeing articles today of like, when Pogacar lines up, forget about winning. It's like, did I sleep through the last two Tours de France? Like, he's losing big race. Like, it's not that he's unbeatable. It's just the good guys never race each other anymore. These guys are great riders, great, fantastic riders. But everyone you mentioned, Johan, like, you could run this race a million times and they're never going to beat him. I was actually trying to think, is there a single mountain stage where in any race where Landa, Bernal, Vlasov, Mas have beaten Pogacar? Maybe when he cracked at the Tour on the Col de la Loz, that might be it. You know, it's just not the same level of rider, which is amazing because you have last year's Vuelta winner and last year's Giro d'Italia runner up. But that's the gulf between the guys who can win the Tour and the rest of the GC riders. I mean, they're just not even in the same conversation.
Yeah, those two are different. They're in another league. But I mean, you know, winning four stages, he did say in his interviews, which you know makes sense, because they say that, you know, some of them asked, yeah, are you not trying to win too much? Are you not, you know, too greedy? Or and he says, listen, you know, my team works hard for this. You know, I mean, every stage they work, and if we try to control the race and I have the opportunity to win, I need to try to win it for them, which is very logical in my opinion. You know, I mean, if you're such a strong team and you do all that hard work and you have your leader basically just sitting there, and then, you know, what do you think Marc Soler and Almeida and I don't know who the other one was, Groschartner, or when they're pulling, and then let's say Pogacar gets away with Bernal and Landa and he lets Landa win.
Yeah.
You know, okay, because let's be nice to the others, right? I wouldn't like that as a teammate, you know?
No, and it's such a disrespectful. I cannot stand that sentiment. It'd be so disrespectful to your teammate.
Yeah.
And frankly to the race of just like, I felt bad for Landa, so I let him win. And I mean, we could discuss all day, like, winning, like, if you do that, you've then chipped away at the winning mentality of the team. And when things get hard at the Tour, maybe you won't be able to dig as deep because you haven't ingrained winning into your mindset. So you have to win as much as you can. But he said, I think this week or last week, that he wants to be the best rider of all time. And to be the best rider of all time, you have to win a lot of races. You have to win like 250 races probably. So
he also said that one of his career objectives is to win all seven one week stage races, which is, you know, Paris-Nice, Tirreno, Tour of the Basque Country, Catalunya, Tour of Switzerland, Tour of Romandy, and I'm forgetting one. There's seven. I forgot the other one now.
At some point, though, he might have to race a good rider to do that, is the only problem. Well,
yeah, I mean, he already won Paris-Nice, and he did race Vingegaard there. He won Tirreno, so now he has Catalunya, so he needs Basque Country, Tour of Switzerland, Tour of Romandy. And Dauphiné.
Yep, that's the hardest one, actually, because if you want to be good at the Tour, it's kind of a balancing act there. But JB, you made me think. So Mikel Landa, great. I mean, yesterday's stage I thought was like, if you're going to like look at one stage, it's yesterday's stage six. It was really hard. Pogacar is a minute in front of Bernal and Landa, and then they're over a minute in front of Mas and Harper, Chris Harper, who were behind them. But imagine like Tadej Pogacar is working in a coffee shop in Ljubljana, never gets into cycling. We're coming away from this race thinking, wow, Mikel Landa, this guy could win the Tour. He just won Catalunya. He looks incredible. Right. He stomped everybody. So it is funny how black and white everything is. It's like everyone's saying, oh, Landa sucks. He, you know, he's 3.5 minutes behind Pogacar. It's like, well, if Pogacar wasn't here, he would have beaten Bernal by 1.5 minutes. That's pretty good.
Yeah, well, I mean, speaking of Bernal, I think we need to mention, you know, but Egan Bernal being back on the podium of a big World Tour stage race is, I think, a milestone in his way back to being as good as he can be after his terrible accident 2 years ago. For the people, you know, who don't know, Egan Bernal had this terrible accident while he was training in Colombia. You know, hit the back of a bus, was, you know, they were fearing for his life at first, then they were fearing if he would ever be able to walk again. And finally, you know, the news came that, you know, he would be able to recover, but, you know, a big accident with so many fractures, multiple surgeries. To see him back at a good level is really nice to see. You know, I think he's back where he belongs. You know, he's there, up there with all the good guys.
Do you think he is back? Is he at the same level? Like, is he at his best level ever? If we looked at his power files,
I don't think so. I don't. I think Egan Bernal of 2019, when he won the tour, he was. I don't know. I don't know the numbers. You know, from a visual point of view, I still think that there's room for improvement, which I'm sure he will, because this must be a confidence booster for Egan Bernal. Incredibly, but and then, you know, we have to see if his best level of Bernal 2019, what's that worth against the level of Vingegaard and Pogacar and even Roglic and Remco when they're at their best. But he's definitely up there with, you know, the big five, the big six, let's say, as a stage racer. So I think that in itself is a huge success for him.
The only thing about that 2019 tour, did he ever drop everybody at that race? Yeah. Maybe the stage they called off. Was he?
Yeah, yeah, that's why he won the tour and on the
with the mudslide
on the called the Iseron or Isoar. I don't remember now which one it was, but yeah, he dropped everybody there.
Is that his only? Well, no, 2021 Giro, he was really good. Actually, that's the hipster take. It's not the 2019 Tour that's his best race ever. It's the 2021 Giro. Uh-huh. He was quite explosive there.
Yeah.
Okay. Another thing about Bernal is that I've totally forgotten as I said that. But how does he fit in to? So his races are, is he doing the tour, not doing the tour? Like, his goal for later in the year?
I don't know. I mean, I think with Bernal, I don't think Ineos even, I don't think they have set it in stone. They're probably wanting to see how it goes and they'll adjust along the way. It's not like Ineos right now is in a position that they can say, okay, this is our program, this is our leader for this race. They don't have that. They don't have one. Right. I mean, it's not like they have a clear leader who they think that has a guaranteed spot on the podium of the tour. You know, they have Bernal, they have Carlos Rodriguez, they have Pitcock, they have Geraint Thomas.
Full of leaders.
Those yes, but guys. Leaders that are not as good as the two strong guys of Vingegaard and Pogacar. So is third place their biggest objective? Could be. So I don't know. I don't know what Bernal's objective is. To me, it looks, I mean, if I would be his advisor, I would say, listen, you know, we are back at a good level now. Let's keep building on this. Let's not set any specific goals or obsessions. Let's just try to get back into it. But, you know, if I'm Bernal, then my big goal for the next 2-3 years is try to win the Vuelta.
Yeah, I was just going to say the Vuelta,
which,
should be...
you know, the question is that this year or is that next year? To me, it feels like he needs this year to get back at the level and then have a go at the Vuelta next year. And then he would have won all three. And then it still depends whether, you know, Pogacar or Vingegaard or Roglic want to do the Vuelta, right? That's a different question.
Yeah, that depends. Yeah, the tour will decide what happens at the Vuelta. I mean, what if, you don't know. I mean, what if Vingegaard and Pogacar aren't healthy? What if they don't want to race it? Then it's somewhat wide open. You know, I do it logically. I agree with you that he's building through this year, but he's good. He's quite good this year. So I wouldn't totally write off that Vuelta. A weird race.
But in general, the Vuelta is the race that, you know, unless you're a young rider on a Spanish team, you could say, okay, this is my goal, right? But usually before the season, the Vuelta is never a set goal from the start. It kind of gets decided during the spring or even, you know, during the tour when something goes wrong in the tour.
Yeah, it's also slightly uncomfortable because he might be Carlos Rodriguez, we don't really know, and he's quite good, but you kind of wonder, is Bernal going to be the team's best GC option when they get to the tour?
I think they should go with multiple guys. I mean, they don't have to carry the weight of the race. They can go easily with three guys that go for GC, and then during the race, you know, already during the race, one of those three will not be at the level that they expect. So that brings it down to two. And then still, even if you have two guys, sometimes you don't even need to make a choice, because if the first two guys are unbeatable, then it's maybe good to try to be third and fourth together as a team. You know, why not?
Yeah, I mean, we saw that at the Giro where they had second place and then they had guys fighting for eighth and ninth.
Yeah.
Just completely independent of that. One thing I want to ask you, and I normally wouldn't bring this up because he's 21 years old, but I bring it up because of the way he left his former team, Utebrooks, this week. I mean, Utebrooks all season, I do not think he's looked as good as he did at Bora. He's supposed to lead Visma at the Giro in 5 weeks.
That's true.
Yeah. What level of panic should there be? Because, you know, he's got plenty of time as 21 years old, but let's say he has two disappointing years. Visma doesn't re-sign him. The way he was pretty, I would not say he left Bora on good terms. Like, that's not going to endear him to other teams. Mm-hmm. I just worry about this spiraling out of control.
Well, I mean, it's okay. It's obviously he was not good this week, but hey, it's, you know, it's early days, and you know, he hasn't lost his talent. I don't know. I mean, for some reason, I mean, it's not just Uitenbroeks in Vuelta a Catalunya. If you look, Visma was nowhere. You know, Sepp Kuss was supposed to be the guy. He was, I don't know if he was sick or if something else was wrong, but he was definitely not up to the level that we expected from him. Especially because Catalunya is kind of his, you know, his home race, because he lives there. He's married to a Catalan woman. I don't know.
Do you know how many times he's finished in the top 10 at a major 1 week stage race?
I don't.
One time.
Okay.
He has more top 10s in Grand Tours than once the week stage races. Cause I too, Johan, was like,
that's an interesting stat.
Huh? That's weird that he doesn't look better. Then I sort of think, actually, I've never seen him look good at a 1 week stage race. So maybe it's just something about the rhythm of that doesn't suit him.
Yeah.
All right. Any other takeaways from Catalunya before we move on to Gent-Wevelgem? Spencer, you usually have something else random up your sleeve.
Oh, yeah. I actually have one more. So did you talk about Axel Lawrence in your up-and-comer show? I know we were talking about it the night before the show.
We did not. We did not. But we should have. We should have. Because, you know, the guy's super talented. Under 23 world champion. But, you know, since he was already on Alpecin last year, we didn't consider him as like one of those up-and-comers, but he is definitely an up-and-comer, super talented rider.
Big talent. And then, you know, it's like you were saying, and I've seen a little sneak peek of your Hino conversation, and he talks about the need to basically get out of France for these young French riders, and he's on Alpecin, a Belgian team, same path that Julian Alaphilippe took, and it served him well. So that's a good sign.
Yeah. Now the guy's a racer, you know, I mean, he's obviously not a Grand Tour rider, but he's a punchy rider who knows how to win races. It's not the last time we see him win at the highest level.
All right. Now we're going to move on to Gent-Wevelgem. Before we get to that, we do want to check in with a couple of our partners, and we appreciate you guys supporting our partners. And if you haven't noticed, we've added a lot more programming And especially in the last year, we've added all this Move Plus, Move Legends. And then your support of our sponsors definitely helps us support women's cycling, which we've got a pretty lofty calendar ahead of us with Allie and Mari and Lance covering most of that. So thank you for your support, for any of your support with our partners. And we'll check in with a couple of them right now. Today's show is brought to you by AG1. It's amazing how quickly you don't even have to say Athletic Greens anymore and people know what you're talking about. Anytime I mention AG1, I'm holding up a pack here if you're watching on YouTube, to somebody, they're like, oh yeah, of course they know it. They're familiar with it. They've either tried it or are using it on the regular now. It's just become a regular staple of people who just want to live, feel better. You know, you get all the daily dose of vitamins and minerals, pre and probiotics that you need. It's a very powerful, healthy habit. And it's also powerfully simple, just a scoop of this and some water every day, make it part of your routine. And it just works so great. If there's a product that I would recommend to elevate your health, it's AG1. That's why we've been partners with them for so long. Try AG1 and get a free one-year supply of vitamin D3 plus K2 and five free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase exclusively at drinkag1.com/themove. Today's show is also brought to you by Caldera Labs. And if you've been listening to the show over the summer, this is for those watching on YouTube, this is the product that George, I swear he would sell one of his children for this. It's called The Good, and it's a serum that you use at night. All right. So I've got this base layer stuff that I use during the day after I get out of the shower, put that on. And then at night, The Good. Again, everybody on the We Do team is, we're all dudes. We weren't taking care of our skin at all. And now we're all addicted to it and we're borrowing it from each other. It's like, hey, do you have any base layer? I'm feeling a little dry here. We're fans of it. You will be too. You're probably out in the sun a lot like we are, and you're probably not taking care of your skin. You can start today, right? Why put it off? Get 20% off with the code WEDO at calderalab.com. You can make unforgettable first impressions that lead to charming words, the charming words, you look younger. 20% off at calderalab.com with the code WEDO. And last but not least, we got to spend this morning watching Gent Wevelgem. And I've got to tell people, I'm going to, if you have not listened to our additional show, just a minute ago, I mentioned all the new programming we've added. If you haven't heard Johan and Spencer on Outcomes, you are completely missing out. It not only is it just for sports betting, if that's something you want to do or are interested in, but just your pre-race take on it and who to watch for. And everyone, I think everyone on the planet was like, okay, Matthew Vanderpool is the guy to beat. But Johan actually called the winner on Outcomes with Mads Pedersen.
But to be fair, I picked both. I picked Vanderpool and Pedersen. So, but I mean, they were first and second. They were together in the breakaway. Before the big races, Spencer and I go over, you know, the chances of the big favorites, and it's definitely something that I would recommend for people who are interested and want a little bit of direction, I would say, or some extra information if they want to place a bet now and then on a bike race.
And you'll get that with our season pass, by the way, at wedo.team. Mm-hmm. And in the recent weeks, we're having a couple issues with our software provider. We've switched. We've got that out. Members, we had a couple glitches on a couple shows, but we've sorted that. Get a season pass at wedo.team. You get discounted apparel. The show Outcomes is great leading into a show. It makes it that much more fun to watch.
So Spencer, the price was amazing too. +800. And I bet on all the things. Every rider we pick on the show, I personally bet on, just so it's not like, it doesn't seem like we're just like shilling picks onto people. And so I was happy with that, Johan. Thanks for the.
Well, also the difference between first and second, we got that right.
I know. Yeah. Yeah.
And for those who did not see it, it came down to Vanderpool and Mads Pedersen, and you just a head-to-head sprint. It I think everyone watching was like, okay, here's what's going to go down. It's Vanderpool's going to come around, and mm-hmm. that will be it.
Yeah, well,
tried to come around, and it was just a slug. Like, who could keep their legs from exploding first? It was amazing.
Yeah, Mads Pedersen is a special guy. You know, he's won some big races. This is the second time he wins Gent-Wevelgem, by the way. But you know, let's go back to when he won the world championships. You know, he was up there also. I mean, I think Van der Poel was even in that breakaway initially, when Mats won.
He was, and then the lights went out.
Yeah, he bonked. Yeah. But you know, after a hard race, man, Mats Pedersen is not just a sprinter. He's a strong guy. And to me, you know, if you look at the race, it's been a hard race. You know, it's been very nervous already from more than 100 kilometers out. You know, you have this typical stretch there through the Flanders. It's called the Muren, which is like a stretch. It's always windy there. So it was super nervous already heading into there. And from then on, the pace has been incredibly fast, hard racing. Everything split up, you know, coming back together. But, you know, the first time they went up the Camelberg, Van der Poel, put the hammer down. He was the first guy on top, but he did not get away like he did in E3. We had, was it Jonathan Milan and Stuyven with him, or was it Pedersen with him?
There was originally more riders with him. So Pedersen was like right on him all day. So Pedersen's right on him. Stuyven's there. And then Rasmus Tiller, Tim Van Dyke, Lawrence Pithy, and Jonathan Milan. And then up, they get up and over the climb, and then Milan attacks Van der Poel, which I was surprised to see.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, initially you would say, okay, this is going to be the Van der Poel show again. You know, the last time up the Camelberg, which, you know, they do the Camelberg three times. It's a cobbled climb, steep. The first two times it's the easy side, I would say, but it's still hard. And then the last time they come from the other side, and that's really super steep. This is where World Van Aert and Laporte went away last year. So I was expecting, okay, this is going to be aggressive riding. Last time up the Camelberg, Van der Poel is going to put in that, you know, typical acceleration like he did in E3 and, you know, go to the finish. It was 35K to go, I think, from the top of the Camelberg to the finish. But, you know, this picture here I have behind me, it's there for a purpose. This is the last time up the Camelberg. And you have Mats Pedersen, who was already pulling about like 300-400 meters before the cobbled section, quite hard. And he gets on the cobbles and accelerates. And Van der Poel can do is just try to stay on the wheel. From there on, from the top of the Camelberg, I thought, okay, this is going to be interesting because Van der Poel is not guaranteed to win here. Otherwise, he would have tried. Even if Pedersen would have come back, he would have tried to distance him. They did distance the Groupama FDG guy, Lawrence Pithy?
Yeah, Lawrence Pithy.
Lawrence Pithy, strong rider, super strong, young rider. He's been at the front several times now in these races. So definitely a name to write down for the future. But from then on, you know, it was those two guys. And then whatever happened behind, there was, you know, some attempts to organize other teams, but, you know, these guys were just, you know, the fact that they were riding together, these two big engines against then, you know, the second or third best riders of the other teams. It's a Mats game, you know, I mean, they were not going to catch them. And especially Spencer, I've wrote down here in my notes, you know, like, when they get to the last kilometer, they still have 45 seconds and goes down to 35, comes down to 27. And then Van der Poel kind of forces the first position onto Pedersen. And normally what you would have then is, you know, looking at each other, hesitating, and Pedersen starting to try to get Van der Poel back into first position. And he didn't. He just did not doubt. He just kept the tempo, didn't look back, and just started his sprint from quite far out, actually. I think about 300 meters to go, 250, 300 meters to go. Pedersen felt he was the strongest. We can't see this on TV, but these, you know, if you're two guys of that level taking pulls, they know who's the strongest. They feel who's the strongest. They feel who's just that tiny bit better. And it's actually also what Van der Poel said. You know, he felt underway that Pedersen was just a little bit stronger than him, that he didn't have the same legs than 2 days ago, which, you know, that's the beauty about bike racing, you know, that these guys are not the same every day.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and Pedersen's freakishly good at these. Like, this was a 250 kilometer plus race, which is why we didn't pick Lawrence Pithy, even though it was tempting. And for a while, it looked like he might win. He's 21 years old. He's not going to be able to last 250K. Pedersen, yeah, as you say, just on the front, never seemed to doubt it. And it's not like, for a second, I thought, is Vanderpool going to come around him? And then Vanderpool had to sit up. He couldn't even sprint for the same amount of time as Pedersen, let alone at the same speed. But if we wind this back up and go back to that Kemmelberg, where they get multiple riders over the Kemmelberg, Vanderpool's alone, Milan attacks. I mean, that to me, that was key, because Pedersen's sitting on Vanderpool. Vanderpool then has to decide, you know, he could have sat up and said, you know, I have Jasper Philipsen behind. Let's just regroup. I'll pull Philipsen to the line. We'll win this in a sprint. But he chased Milan. It was, are these Ploeg streets new? I swear I don't remember always seeing them at.
It's the last Hoboken. Few editions.
Like them a lot.
2 or 3 years. I'm not a fan.
Because it broke that group up.
I know, Spencer, but you know, I mean, adding these kind of roads, man, it's just add another factor of where, you know, mechanical, you know, flat tires can come into the game. And
yeah.
Describe to everybody what you're talking about, Spencer, in particular.
I mean, it's basically just a gravel road, right? It's just a fancy term for a gravel road, like a dirt road that they add into the race. It's like not cobblestones.
Ploeg is plow. You know, like they're like, you know, they're basically farmer roads.
Yeah, that are unpaved.
Yeah.
And you think you suggest they're adding these to make it a little more sensational, but
they do. I mean, yeah, but you know, Gent-Wevelgem is already, you know, like typically Gent-Wevelgem was the classic for sprinters, right? I mean, Cipollini's won it, you know, there's a bunch of sprint. Bonin's won it 3 times, I think.
George Hincapie.
George won it. Yeah, George won it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Not in a bunch sprint though, in a breakaway.
Yeah.
You know, it's then they put the Kemmelberg in, right? And then a few other of those hills. That was already okay. It takes away the identity of Gent-Wevelgem. Okay, fine. You know, it's still a decent amount of kilometers from the finish. A strong sprinter can make it back. You can win still Gent-Wevelgem in the sprint. You still can do it, but you know, adding gravel roads wherever they can, I mean, I'm not a fan. I'm definitely it's okay. You know what? It's a 1 day race. That's okay. It's fine. You know, I mean, if you have a problem, okay. You know, it's not a big deal. You know, the tendency of adding these things in Grand Tours, however, I'm completely not in favor.
But in general,
people seem to like it. People seem to like it. So it's great TV. It's great for the viewers. It's, I'm pretty sure the riders don't like it, and the mechanics don't like it, and the teams don't like it.
Well, if I'm a sprinter, I want more opportunities. And it seems it's been trending away from in the Grand Tours, sprinter opportunities, where we used to see a lot more, especially in the first week.
Yeah.
So again, if this is historically a sprinter's finish, yeah, you're taking another one away from them.
Well, even if we set the judgment aside of whether we like it or not, or agree with it, it probably fundamentally changed the race, because with 80K to go, Milan is in front of the Vanderpool group with Pedersen and Stuyven there, two teammates. The peloton's only 25 seconds behind them. I think without the Ploeg streaks, I don't think Vanderpool would have said, I'm going to sit on the front and reel in Jonathan Milan with two of his teammates on my wheel. He probably waits for the peloton and they regroup, and maybe Philipsen wins this race. I mean, you don't know, but I do think it fundamentally altered the race, because he thought, I'll just get to the Ploeg streets, attack, drop these guys, I'll bridge up to Milan. Now I'm soloing to the race win.
Yeah. Well, it didn't turn out that way. You know, listen, I mean, I'm like you, Spencer. When I saw Van der Poel in E3, I said, wow, this guy is incredibly strong. How are they going to beat him? You know, what do they need to do to beat him? Well, 2 days later, he's beaten, and not by Wout van Aert.
Yeah, I mean, in Little Trek, like, I just have so much respect for them because they weren't afraid at E3. They get whacked, you know, absolutely just took it on the chin. They come into today with a really good plan, and they're really aggressive. Like, they're not sitting back. You know, you see this so much. You see this at Catalunya, and that's a different race, but it's just like, oh, like, I'm just waiting for Tadej to kick him in the face. You know, it's like,
yeah,
they didn't do that. They took the race to Vanderpool again, and it worked. And
yeah, I mean,
JD, do you remember?
They have strong riders who are in amazing shape. You know, Pedersen looked like he was a tiny bit off in E3. Today was a completely different rider. Stuyven is good, had a mechanical. Milan was surprisingly strong. I'm impressed with Milan, you know, because he's, you know, in theory, he's a sprinter, super young. I mean, to be able to be there with these guys after a few times up the camel and then try is even, you know, go try to get in an attack and then even sprint. I think he's, what is he, like fifth or sixth or something?
Yeah, I thought he was going to get third, but he got fifth.
Yeah. So Little Trek, I mean, they've got their homework done for sure. They're ready as a team.
And JB said last year, like at the Giro, he's like, yeah, if Milan gets to a different team, this guy might be an incredible rider. And that's exactly what's happened. Got the Little Trek. And as you said about the sprinter's chances, I think in the future, sprinters have to make their own chances. They'll have to race like Jonathan Milan did today because these races are just getting harder and harder. You're not going to be able to sit back. You know, we saw right before the Kimmelberg, right then I thought, they might catch this group. It was a 30-second gap-ish, but there's no one in the peloton wanted to pull because they're like, well, I don't want to pull into the Kimmelberg and then my sprinter gets dropped. And then what was the point of that? So they're all kind of waiting to see what would happen. Gave them just enough time to hold them off. And you might have thought, I kind of thought they were just tapping through Pedersen and Vanderpool, but they showed the speeds and the peloton was going 54K an hour into the finish. So they were going.
You know what? It could have been different. You know what I mean? Like they did obviously understand each other, Pedersen and Vanderpool. There was no hesitation at all. If they start to look at each other a little bit, I mean, a pure sprinter could have won Gent Wevelgem. You know, we had Olaf Kooi in there. We had Dylan Groenewegen in there. We had Tim Merlier in there. You know, and Jasper Philipsen, of course. And the guy who got third, Jordi Meus, is a pure sprinter. The guy who won the last stage of the Tour de France on the Champs-Élysées last year wins the sprint for third. So it could have been a pure sprinter who won. You know, it was just those two guys. And then how big would that group have been? Like 40, 50 guys probably.
It's a huge group. 40, it'd be like 45 people. I guess we could debate this all day. If it is a big group, do attacks start flying? But you know, there were enough sprinters in there. There's like probably eight sprinters that could have won it. So maybe they do stay together.
Yeah.
Not to put you guys too much on the spot, but who's your favorite looking ahead to Flanders? I know you've got outcomes coming end of the week, but I want to know. I think a lot of people want to know your early.
Well, Johan, you said something yesterday that I thought was quite prescient. You said Pedersen hasn't looked good. Like he's looked empty at the end of San Remo. He didn't look good at E3. And he said like, that can often mean that there's good things to come.
Good. That form is coming.
Yeah. I kind of think that about Van Aert. And if you look at Vanderpool, it's just, you know, he could easily win Flanders. Obviously the guy's incredible, but the rider who's been the king of E3 and Gent Wevelgem in recent years hasn't necessarily translated to Flanders. So that's the only thing that gives me pause about Vanderpool and makes me wonder if Van Aert is playing this perfectly, even though he's taking a lot of crap at home right now.
Yeah, I mean, I personally think that the planning of the altitude camp, you know, is on purpose. They know that, you know, like a week to 10 days after you come back from altitude, that's when you're going to reach, I mean, or at least some riders. Some riders are good straight away, some other riders, but, you know, normally, you know, 7 to 10 days afterwards, you should be good. You know, you had time to adjust to the altitude, the sea level. I personally expect Van Aert to be on a good level, on a really strong level. He was already, he got criticized. He was a lot better than people would imagine yesterday. His basic form, his endurance, his super high. And it's just that little tiny bit of top end, which, you know, sometimes you need in a race like E3, but maybe sometimes like in Tour of Flanders, it's 260 or almost 270K. You don't need that top speed. You just need to be like, be able to go for as long as you can.
It's such a good point. I mean, E3 is a very different race than Flanders. You do not have to be as explosive to win Flanders.
Exactly. Yeah. But you still need to be explosive. You mean you still need to be able to, you know, either make the difference or stay with the guy who attacks on the Quaremont and the Paterberg. But I'm guessing that if Van Aert watched the last time of the Camelback today, he got hope because Mathieu was fighting to stay with Pedersen, and that was not the case 2 days ago.
I mean, I guess we're being a little disrespectful to Mads Pedersen and Little Trek. Like, their team is so good. Visma hasn't looked good, but as you say, Johan, we haven't seen their A team together in the last.
For Flanders and Roubaix. I mean, Roubaix is different because it's also more of a lottery, and you know, there's more crashes, more punctures, more mechanical problems. In Flanders, Visma will be there. They'll be there.
Now, it's interesting what you just have brought up, because earlier you were talking about how it just seems to be the strongest race of attrition. Now in my head, I'm connecting the dots. When you get to the bigger monuments, the team is more stacked. There's more depth. It becomes much more tactical and less about being purely the strongest. Does that sound accurate?
Well, yeah, it does. It does. But, you know, in my opinion, if Visma shows up with a super strong team and everybody of their team is at full power or at their full potential, Van der Poel, his best chances are to open the race early and basically, you know, isolate, let's say, Van Aert with maybe one other guy of his team, you know, rather than if Van der Poel waits. The deeper they get into the race and the race is not aggressive, the more the pawns will have to play with, you know, and then they can send a Van Baarle or Teach Benoit or Matteo Jorgensen up front. And then what's Van der Poel going to do? He has to go and get them, and Van Aert can follow him.
Yeah, it is the beauty of the new course at Flanders. It's a lot. Some people don't like it because it is a little paint by numbers, but it keeps a team from stacking a bunch of riders late because it's so, so hard. Those final laps are so hard. It's kind of hard to imagine Visma having like four riders, but Jorgensen's strong enough that he could be there over the top of the last Paterberg. Things could get interesting because if he can.
Yeah, and also, Spencer, the question is, will, you know, the last time they go up the Quaremont and the Paterberg and Tour of Flanders, will the big favorites already be in pole position? You know, if Visma has, for example, a Van Baarle up front, and, you know, if Van der Poel, I mean, I'm pretty sure if he doesn't do it, his team will do it. You know, Van Baarle has gone always at the same point in Flanders, somewhere in between two of these climbs. That's where he goes, you know, and he's done it over and over again. So, if Van Baarle is healthy, and I don't know if it was because of the puncture or if it was because of something else, but if he's strong and healthy, they will anticipate with Van Baarle. So that's what Van der Poel would have to, you know, because if Van Baarle is ahead before the Quaremont and the Paterberg, then it's a different race.
Yeah, and there's no Pogacar. I mean, I kind of thought that was last year. He was just so good on those climbs. It was hard for any tactics to come in, but without him, it could be a lot more interesting.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, we'll look forward to this week's outcome show with you guys. And I cannot leave here without hyping people about a Move Legends show that they're going to get this week. Johan has been knocking it out of the park.
On Tuesday, we're airing a really, really interesting interview I did with nobody less than Bernard Hinault, 5-time Tour de France winner, 3-time Giro winner, I think, 2-time Vuelta winner, world champion, won, you know, Paris-Roubaix and Liège-Bastogne-Liège twice and a bunch of other races. You know, he's considered, you know, the last big patron of the peloton, last French Tour de France winner also. So I've asked him all of those questions. I had the privilege to travel to Bretagne in France and interviewed him at his home. And it's definitely an interview I recommend. Super interesting. It's in French with English subtitles.
Yeah, so it'll be a YouTube watch for you. Yeah. Or maybe on our Facebook page, you can watch it. But YouTube, you can get the subtitles. We're working on some audio translation and see how well it turns out to switch it to English. That, because I just say that because our audience is 10 times more that just prefer the audio. But this one, you may want to just do the subtitle on YouTube. Yeah. So watch our socials and give us a follow over there and you'll get the details on that. All right. I'm going to let you guys go. Spencer, Johan, thank you. That's a lot of racing to cover. And again, appreciate you guys and look forward to your Flanders outcome show. And then we'll be back next weekend for Flanders coverage.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah.
Good show. Thanks, JB. Yeah.